News Talk Breakfast.
In association with AIR, the home of Ireland's largest 5G network.
This is News Talk.
Good morning. This is News Talk Breakfast with Shane Coleman and Kieran Cuddihy. It is Thursday, the 23rd of January.
On the show this morning, fears over coronavirus. Dublin, one of the worst cities to bring up a family. Irish tax system helps reduce inequality. And who won the big debate?
Well, I care deeply about our country. I care deeply about the problems that people face.
I believe our country needs a new government. It needs a government which will put aside the obsession with party politics.
Also coming up on the show, is phone use actually bad for kids? Peter Casey and why he's running in two constituencies. Thieves using fitness apps to find targets. And Rory Best speaks about his appearance at the Belfast rape trial.
I look back now and I do think that I was used. I didn't ever think that it would be that case, but it suited the defence to have me there.
In sport, another fine mess. Ollie, is it time for change as United lose at home to Burnley?
All that and more, but first of the morning headlines, here's Andrea Gilligan. Now, Wuhan, the Chinese city, nearly 9 million people live there. It's temporarily to shut public transport as it tries to halt the outbreak of this coronavirus. For more, we're joined by Killian de Gascon, who's director of the National Virus Reference Lab at UCD. Hey, Killian, shutting down a city of 9 million people or the transport around it is no small task. What sort of fatality rate are we looking at from this virus?
Morning, Karen. Thanks for having me. At the moment, we're probably looking at something in the region of 2 to 2.5%, but it's probably a little bit early to start talking about case fatality rates when we don't know exactly how many people have been affected. We've obviously heard reports in the news about how many laboratory confirmed cases there are, but it seems as if this virus leads to a spectrum of illness. So there's probably cases that haven't been detected, and equally there are still people in the hospital and we don't know what's going to happen to them. So it's probably early to start talking about case fatality rates really, but at this stage I think it's probably in the region of 2 to 2.5%, something in that area.
2 to 2.5%, and that would mean something to you. It doesn't mean anything to a lot of us. Like, how does that compare to other viruses?
Okay, so I guess it is very significant, and the WHO and China, I think, have acted very, I suppose, swiftly in this case, and I think they have to be careful and err on the side of caution, because we have to try and learn from the past. And people remember SARS from 2003, and people remember MERS from 2012. So SARS infected about 8,000 people, killed about 800, so a case fatality rate of about 10%. MERS has infected about 2,500 people with a case fatality rate of between 30 and 35%. So these are really significant case fatality rates when you think about seasonal influenza, which has a case fatality rate of 0.1%.
7:41 on News Talk Breakfast with Kieran Cuddihy and Shane Coleman. Now, Rory Best has spoken out about his role in the 2019 trial of Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olinger. Speaking last night on Off the Ball, the former Ireland captain told Joe Malloy he felt his status as Ulster and Ireland captain was used by Jackson's legal team to benefit their client.
I look back now and I do think that I was used. Didn't ever think that it would be that case, but I have no doubt, like you said yourself, that it suited the prosecution to have me there.
The defence, to
have me there because of, and I think that I became a pawn in it, and that is the bit that, like,
yeah,
I think now in hindsight, you know, looking at that, you know, it was bad advice for me to be there. And look, I was, like I say, naive enough to think that I could go there as a friend. And look, I accept exactly what you're saying. And like, ultimately, you know, you go to all these roles as the captain, and I don't know why I thought this would be different, but look, ultimately I did. And that is one of the things that I'm very sorry for, because it was never, ever my intention to cause any more distress on what was a very, very difficult day for that poor girl anyway.
In the studio, you're looking at two men, two human beings. At home, you're looking at two images, and you've got split screens, you've got close-ups, you know, you can see the quiver on the upper lip, which I can't see in studio. So it's hard. I mean, I thought even Stephen, in terms of, you know, they landed a few blows on each other. Also, you're not sure how much of the interaction when they're talking over each other is getting through. And, you know, that's the, if you compare it to a boxing ring, that's when they're in tight together and they're giving rapid punches to the back of the neck and little digs here and there. So I'm going to ask our listeners in a few minutes, you know, who do they think won? And you know,
they
would
both
it change?
They nervous, didn't they, beforehand? I was kind of surprised.
The strange thing is that before the show, both were very relaxed, and equally after the show. I mean, there's no personal antipathy between the two men, even though they have a go at each other across the chamber all the time. They, you know, quite affable with each other. I thought when they had to present 60 seconds at the beginning, at the end, that's when they were least comfortable in a way.
Yeah.
You know, scripted pieces that they read from the auto cue and, you know, well worked out and so on. But the difference between reading a script, which is a skill that you learn over the years, working in television, it's not something that people do all that regularly. To make that real is very hard. And I didn't think either of them made it real.
I thought Leo's end was quite good, where he, you know, the compare and contrast, and he pointed at Micheál, whereas you, and I actually thought that worked quite well.
He seemed to be quite well prepped. I think if you're looking at expectations, everyone expected Micheál to be smooth and to be assertive and all of that, and people thought that Leo might be less so, that he might be awkward. And he surprised people, I think.
Leo, though, in the Fine Gael hustings for leadership, the third one, down in Cork, it was full of Coveney supporters. Leo wiped the floor with Simon Coveney. He's actually a very good debater when he wants to be. People shouldn't have been expecting such low things from him last night, I think.
Yeah, because I think it's fair to say with the polls and so on that Leo probably went in as underdog. And I think was it Michael McDool yesterday saying that all Micheál had to do was not drop the ball and he would be fine.
And he didn't drop the ball.
And he didn't drop the ball.
No, definitely not.
One thing we didn't get to was this whole thing of whether Micheál is more rural friendly and Leo is more urban friendly. I mean, the whole thing about the drugs, it's interesting. The question, which everyone kind of gasped in a way, you know, oh, what are they going to say? And Leo hesitated, gave his reply about the hot press. But talking to some of the younger members of our staff here, they were saying, you know, to our generation, most people have tried a joint at some point.
Well, I was saying that like a 40-year-old to say that they've tried it, it's a bit of an, like,
it's a given. Yeah, but hang on, the issue wasn't about a joint. The issue was, because if you read the hot press interview, he says, yeah, he smoked a joint, and then he was asked about other drugs. That was the.
But the point being,
he doesn't say
that,
no. He just says, "Well, not since I." Yeah.
All I'm saying is that whatever about my generation, for a generation of 20-somethings, 30-somethings. I'm not suggesting for a moment that Micheál Martin was less than honest. He doesn't look like a man who's
Harry McGee said today that Micheál's the kind of guy who thinks twice about having a second hobnob. So I think we can rest assured that was an honest.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a moment. But first of all, for our listeners, the basic difference between the kind of infections we can get, we can have a bacterium having a go at us, or we can have a virus. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's right. But viruses are tiny things, but they're 40 times smaller than bacteria. That's the first difference between them, right? And they can infect us, obviously, and cause disease. So a virus will cause the common cold, for instance. Some bacteria, again, if you scratch your skin and it all gets infected, that's often a bacteria. So they're both infectious agents that affect our bodies.
But in terms of the kind of molecule they are they very different?
Oh, they're very different, absolutely. Viruses have to live inside our cells. They burrow within cells, say in your lungs, and really infect you, you know, whereas bacteria can live outside, and that's one difference anyway. And then, of course, antibiotics, of course, work against bacteria, but never work against viruses, so that's another difference.
So, you know, the coughs and sneezes spread diseases, so you've got a common cold, which is caused by a virus, and you cough onto your hand, and then you put your hand on the handle of the door.
Yeah.
How long, given that viruses need a cell to thrive, how long will it stay living on the handle of that door to infect somebody else?
It depends on the virus, but if it's inside cells and those cells are on the door, they can live for a few hours, you know, that kind of time frame. 12 hours, sometimes 24 even. Some of the more robust ones live a bit longer. You know?
So when I'm coughing out the virus, I'm coughing out the virus which is buried within a cell.
Exactly, that's the usual thing. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Now, let's talk about about the coronavirus and where it came from.
Well, this is a brand new virus, by CC. We love this. You see this Hollywood movies, a new virus emerges, and this is a brand new virus, never seen before on Earth, as it were, you see. And that gets people slightly concerned, because would it be more dangerous than previous ones? And you remember SARS, Pat? That's 2002. There was this thing called SARS, and this virus is in the same family. So it must be sort of a descendant, if you like, of SARS. And that's why it's a cause of concern, because SARS did wreak somewhat havoc, you know, back in 2002.
Yeah. Now, it wrought havoc because the Chinese didn't get a handle on it early enough.
That's right. Now, that's what's happening now, by the way. The Chinese are all over this like a rash, if I can use an infectious phrase, because they were criticised. They kept things quiet, you know, didn't contain it quick enough. Now, they're moving very fast on this one to avoid any criticism, I guess, is the idea. It's not especially dangerous now, this virus. Let's not worry people at this stage. And the World Health Organization haven't declared an emergency yet.
Yeah. I mean, we're told 2.5% of those who contract the virus might die, compared to Ebola, 10%, or maybe it's more
higher
in the case of Ebola.
Yeah, that's right.
But the flu, 0.1% of 1%.
That's right. Yeah, but of course, the scaremongering, just as I was waiting to come in for the Daily Express, as it could be as dangerous as the 1918 flu, which killed millions, remember. And that's not the case. That's awful nonsense in the media sometimes. You know? But it is true, it does kill people. The people dying are older people, though.
I suppose you should be pushing for things like SNAs if you're at that level and all of those things, but it is about pushing, which I personally think is wrong. I don't think you should have to be in this position and push. I think there should be a system that's more facilitative. But anyway, Mark's on the line from Dublin. Mark, you are 53, and am I right in reading this? You were diagnosed with dyslexia last week?
Yeah.
Good Lord. Tell me about that.
Tell you about that.
Did you?
It was suggested to me. Well, first of all, when I was in school, I was a disaster. So I was just diabolical at everything academically through school.
Okay.
I was a popular kid. I was a funny kid.
Yeah.
So that side of things, that side of things was fine. So that's probably where I focused my time. But as regards learning and my studies, just diabolical. I failed my undercert twice. I didn't do my leaving cert because I wouldn't have passed it. I went into ANCO and started to train to be an office equipment engineer, learning about photocopiers and typewriters back then. And as soon as I went there and as soon as I went to work, I excelled, I flew. And I started my own business when I was 25 and I succeeded very well.
And did you, Mark? Were you one of those people you thought, well, I'm bright, I'm capable, I'm sociable, and I'm not, and I'm using inverted commas nearly, I'm not academic, but you were never given any reason for it, or ever. I'd say your confidence wasn't great on that.
Yeah, no, it's worse than that. I actually believed I was stupid.
Ah, pet.
It was suggested by a family member in December that maybe I was dyslexic, and then when I heard that, I thought, okay, well, actually, now that there's more known about dyslexia,
yeah.
I reflected on it and I thought, well, that could make sense, actually. And then I kind of started saying to myself, you know, it started a kind of, not a whirlwind, but a massive reflection curve as opposed to learning curve, a reflection curve of me and my life since I was in school and work and up to today. And I thought, yeah, but sure, how could it possibly be that the kid that was a disaster in school, when he went to work,
yeah.
he excelled
yeah.
and excelled really well
yeah,
and,
yeah.
excelled at things that, okay, I learned stuff, but excelled because it was just intuitive to me to do what I did. Like, how does a kid who I didn't
but
go to college
but you can be so intelligent
business?
And be dyslexic.
Yeah.
They're not one or the other.
Yeah, but the point when I heard you speak about the text at the start of the show that yeah. lady, little girl is diagnosed now. So I'm sure things are different now. First of all, the identification and the reasoning and the understanding is there now. But I'm not sure. This is kind of 2 weeks old for me, a little bit more. But my point is, the sabotage that people like me do to themselves.
I know it.
It's kind of almost a crime, but it's kind of self-inflicted because maybe the knowledge wasn't there when I was a kid.
Yeah.
The support wasn't there when I was a kid.
Because you were growing up, let's just say it, you were growing up believing yourself to be stupid.
Yeah, and believing terrible. Yourself to be stupid destroys your self-confidence.
Of course
it destroys
does.
Your self-esteem. Because if you think about it, I don't know how it is in a classroom today, so there are other people listening that could know. But what do we do in classrooms? So what we do in classrooms is we celebrate the kids that get B's, B pluses, yeah. A's and A pluses. But there's, and we go well done to the kids who get C. But we kind of almost pretend, or this is how it was when I was in school, right? We almost, that's 40 plus years ago. We kind of almost pretend that the D kids aren't there. And the no graders like me, well, they don't even exist. And so if you grow up in an environment like that, well, like that's what your world is. If you think about what is a kid's world to that kid, it's you know, it's, I don't know how many hours, but approximately 8 hours a day in school,
yeah.
right? Or you're, as a, in primary school, you're four or five hours a day, whatever it is in school. So that whole focus of 5 days of your week, all through your year,
Mark,
you're in an environment where
you can
where
well
you don't
believe
accept.
It. And you see yourself at that age, because you're young and you're insecure yeah. anyway, you see yourself through others' eyes. And if you think people think yeah. you're stupid, or the teacher thinks you're stupid, then you just internalize that, and in your head you're stupid. Like, we all have yeah. things that, I was crap at sports. I knew I was crap at sports, and I always kind of,
yeah.
I used to kind of cringe when they were picking teams and things, because I wasn't any good. Like, you internalize yeah. that stuff, and you just take it
yeah,
with you.
And that's the tragedy, but what I've learned in the last week is there's actually great news out there about dyslexia. That what I wanted to contribute to that lady. So my email into you is, look, I'm happy to talk to that lady and explain to her my experience, because understanding a problem is at the root of solving every problem. And so I've immersed myself in TED Talks, in YouTube videos,
yeah.
in the report that was sent to me, in the research that I've been able to do about what dyslexia is and how our minds work, right?
Yeah.
And here's an incredible thing. Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, Thomas Edison, Agatha Christie, Tom Cruise, Pablo Picasso, Leonardo da Vinci, Steven Spielberg, Jamie Oliver, Walt Disney, John Lennon, they're all dyslexic.
Ah, fantastic. That's a great list.
Here's the thing. But here's the thing, Doctor. Here's the thing, right? It's not a coincidence that their brilliance is not a coincidence. Their brilliance is a result of their dyslexia, because we think differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
You make
a very good point. So here's the thing. I'm just thinking off the top of my head today, but that's what dyslexics do, right? I'd like the your show to put out a plea to change the top of all of those forms to learning difficulty, because it's not a learning difficulty, right? Because dyslexic kids...
Is it a learning difference?
Exactly. That's exactly my words. It's not true to say that dyslexic kids cannot learn. It is true to say that paraplegics cannot walk, right? And we don't punish them for it, right? But it's not true to say dyslexics can't learn. We learn differently.
Yeah.
And how old are you yourself, sir?
I'm 47.
So you're 47, and your age group has cocaine crept in amongst peers?
Well, I was an addict for 4 years, heroin. I took my first drug when I was about 12. But I know the consequences of it. I know what you suffer like.
So you got out of that. What was that like, being addicted to heroin for 4 years?
Terrible. You're only existing every day, like... You wouldn't wash yourself. I do see young fellas going around here now, and I know what they're like. I know what they're going through. There's a young fella up there, up at the arcade there, and I do always give them a couple of bob. I know they're going to buy drugs with it, but that's the existence. Do you know what I mean? There's no point giving them a sandwich or a cup of tea because he doesn't want it.
So here in Bray, there is that issue.
Of course there is. You see it all the time. I was just coming down through the town there at the car park, and there's three young fellas that they're running across the road, and they're all out ahead. Do you know what I mean? Running for the bus, but that's the existence. Do you know what I mean?
So what about their kids? What about their families? The fact that the money that's coming in, if they have work or perhaps are on the dole, that isn't...
Well, more than likely they're on the dole. You know, there's no work because you can't work, because you're too sick to work. That's the problem, like, you know what I mean? So all it is you just get whatever money you can, and the problem is that if you're too sick, that you're going to start struggling, or you're going to start robbing people, and you're going to start robbing you start out with your family, your friends, do you know what I mean? And then you lose them one by one. They don't trust you. You can't get a job anywhere. So what do you do? So you have to
you're
go
now a respectable member of society.
That's right, yeah. You
dug yourself out of that hole. How did you do it?
Well, everyone has a little trigger, like, you know what I mean? The trigger for me was my daughter was born. She's 25 now, as I said. When my girlfriend said to me, like, I'm pregnant, I said to myself, well, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of the situation, like, you know what I mean?
And you managed to turn it around.
I did, but I was 4 or 5 times in treatment centres and, you know what I mean, in Pier Street. And trying to get the help is just terrible, like, and the situation, like, back in Bray, like, 25 years ago, it wasn't bad, like, there was only about 10 lads on it. You know, the guards didn't do anything.
So there was just 10. How many now do you think are on drugs?
Well, most of my mates are dead now. Do you know what I mean? Because of it, like.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Do you
that.
Know what I mean? And that's the but they never seem to cop on. Like, people in society, like, people that who make the decisions, like, they never seem to cop on and say, well, we're going to nip this in the bud now. We're going to get them 10 lads treatment and
we'll sort this out.
And we nip this in the bud. You won't let it go any further than Bray. Now it's in every town in the country, like. I moved out of Bray just to get away from it. My daughter came home one day and I got a phone call from the school to say that she had picked up a needle. And that was the trigger then for me to get out of Bray and just change the situation, you know, get out of the town altogether, like, you know. But I woke in Bray.
That's actually government policy. It's not news. It was announced months ago that we would move towards a health-led approach, which would be to caution somebody on the first occasions, maybe link them up with health advice.
And only
prosecute dealers and people who are repeat offenders.
So why the kind of discomfort last night? I mean, like, we read the hot press interview and we talked to and it wasn't clear-cut. I mean, like, when is the last time that you took any form of cannabis or illegal drug?
Look, I suppose I was caught off guard by the question, and even though I've been asked it before and I've answered it before, and, you know, what I never want to get into is that kind of, you know, those kind of, obviously it was all when I was a student and in college.
So you haven't, but, the last time would have been before 2004?
No, like, I'm not the only former teacher who has, by the way.
I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not here. Like, I drink too much. You know what I mean? I beg too much. So I'm not, on
occasion. Yeah. But it's not the kind of thing, you know, that I've ever want to get into much detail about, largely because I appreciate that I am Taoiseach, that I am a role model in a way, and I don't want to send out the message to young people who are under pressure to experiment with drugs or try drugs that it's kind of okay and sure the Taoiseach did it and it's in any way cool, because it's not. Illegal substances can be very deleterious to your health.
What is the answer to the question? When did you last consume any sort of substance like that?
Back when I was a student.
Right. And so, like, I'm just wondering, like, I often think in these things that, because, you know, you'll be doing Brian Dobson tomorrow, you'll be doing Claire Byrne, you'll be doing everyone. This question will continue to come up. Do you have any, like, I have said publicly, what people do in their private time at house parties or anything is their own business and doesn't interfere in any way in your public duties. Like, are you afraid that someone said, well, sure, I was at a party in Castle Knockshire and he was off his head?
Yeah, well, I'm a great believer that politicians should be able to have a private life and should be able to have a private pass as well. And, you know, I spent the last 3 years with two Gardaí with me at all times. So, you know, I think that probably answers that question.
So just to go through, you said about cannabis, I'm not an expert on this, but cocaine, ecstasy, party pills, LSD, ketamine, MDMA, have you consumed any of those substances other than cannabis?
Well, just cannabis. But like I say, you know, I really don't want to get into the detail of this, you know, when, where, who, you know, where did you get it from?
Why not?
Because I think...
You see, sometimes that's the best way to kill a story. Because if you leave a tail on it, you know what I mean? Then it's and this and that and the other. Like, you've got to get to your end position, I find, or it becomes a 9-day wonder.
Yeah, no, like I say, it shouldn't be, because this isn't the first time I've been asked this question, nor is it the first time I've answered it. But the message that I would like to come across is that I don't condone in any way young people or anybody, you know, experimenting because of the potential health consequences of that, and also the fact that we all understand better now than perhaps we did in the past. Certainly, I understand better now than I did in the past the link between consumption of illegal drugs and criminal networks. And we've seen a number of very serious crimes in the last couple of weeks. And the truth is that is fueled by people consuming illegal drugs.
So you never consumed any of these while you were a doctor?
No.
No. And do you think the issue is cleared up? Because you know the way the media are. They're like a rat pack.
Probably not, because, like I say, it kind of comes up every 6 months or a year. It doesn't go up that frequently.
But let's be clear about this. Michael Gove and other people, I don't know how many American politicians, these things, like, it's not the end of the world. Often Obama himself, I mean, the point is this, that if a really sensitive issue comes up, the reason why someone would say, oh, we better not get there, because the answer is worse than the cover-up, we'll just say, or the denial. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not alleging anything. Like, Jeremy Hunt has said he's taking cannabis, Adrian Leadsom, Dominic Raab. I mean, like, any politician would not be alone. Like, do you not think it's better to be fully frank and then say, there's nothing more to be said?
I think I've been fully frank.
Right. So it's open and shut. Since 2004, you have never consumed any such substance.
That's correct.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
All right, I'm delighted to have Camogie legend Anne Downey on the line. Evening, Anne.
Good evening, Nathan. How are you?
Very well. Congratulations on the new role. You're the manager of the St. Patrick's Ballyragget Intermediate Hurlers. Caused quite a stir last week. Were you surprised with the stir and the amount of conversation that was had about it?
I was, to be quite honest. You know, I suppose when I took the job, really, I was just stepping in to help the lads. I had worked with them as probably coach 2009 when they were minors and 2011 when we won the under-21 championship. And, you know, there wasn't much of a stir about things then. And, you know, when I was asked to do the job, I was just delighted and honoured, you know, to be able to help out the club, because I'm from Ballyragget myself, and they've been very good to us over the years, and all the times both Angela and myself were playing, you know, we got great support. So it's great to be able to give back. But, you know, I just can't believe, you know, the amount of airtime that the whole topic has been given so far.
It's hard to know whether it's a positive thing that it's getting so much airtime, that we're having this conversation about a female being in charge of a men's team. And I know Fiona McHale was in studio a few weeks back, who's taking charge of the Claremorris senior football team in Mayo. And it's starting to happen more and more, and it shouldn't be unusual, but unfortunately it is still unusual.
It is, yeah. You know, and there's I could name five or six great coaches, you know, Juliet Murphy down in Cork, Fiona O'Driscoll did a football and a hurling team, actually Father O'Neill's were in the All-Ireland last weekend against Tullerone, and Fiona O'Driscoll had trained them for a long time now. You know, the only difference is, you know, the last time I was with the lads, I was coach. This time I'm manager. The easiest job is probably to be manager. I suppose you're just there because if something goes wrong, you're the person that's going to get the kick in the pants. But there's plenty of good female coaches around in every grade. And I suppose not getting the recognition, and maybe it was just the name that has stirred the interest at this point in time. But, you know, mindsets have changed, and that's a good thing.
Was it an ambition? Was it something you'd been thinking about in recent years, that you'd like to go and get involved as a manager in the men's game? But it sounds like you don't seem to think it's that much of a difference between maybe what you were doing before as a coach.
No, you know, it wasn't an ambition. You know, when I finished with the Camogie team after Galway had beaten us last year, you know, my intention was really just maybe to go back playing a bit of golf and spend some time in Kerry and all the rest. But little did I think that was going to change. And of course, you know, as I said, when the lads came knocking, it was very hard to say no. And it is a great privilege, you know, as I said, to be asked. And the competition in Kilkenny is ferocious. You know, there's, you know, so much hard work that has to be done with every team to try and win either a junior, intermediate or a senior championship. So, you know, while the task is going to be an uphill one, you know, I'm happy to do it, and happy maybe to be able to give my experience that I've gained over the last few years with the Camogie. It's the same, exactly the same principles apply, you know, whether it's a male or female team.